We are now entering the modern era of food production, processing, marketing, retail, and consumption. Every one of those changes completely in this period. We'll begin by focusing on Britain in the late 18th and early 19th century, and a series of events that marks what most food historians contend is the second major revolution in human eating habits in the history of our species. The first, of course, occurred about 10,000 years ago with the Neolithic Revolution, where we began the course, a time when humans went from being hunters and gatherers to farmers, from being nomadic to sedentary, wild to tame, if you will. This second revolution involves a switch from the vast majority of people growing food for a living to most people working in factories and having food provided by a small number of industrialized, organized, and financed food producers. Food production becomes a business separate from most people's daily lives. And obviously, this is a process that takes a good century or so, and then takes even longer to spread around the world. But it begins in Great Britain with two interconnected world-changing events. There is a second agricultural revolution, and then there is the industrial revolution itself. And as we'll see, you wouldn't have had the second without the first. In the midst of these events was an individual probably among the most influential thinkers of all time, a person who heralded the modern era in many ways. And I am talking here about Adam Smith. His Wealth of Nations, published in 1776, predicted the way the economy would work in the age of capitalism. And in brief, he predicted a whole new form of organization for labor. He said, look at what the average worker, or even farmer, does from day to day. At one point, he's got to do this task, then go do something else, and then switch to another task. And he's constantly switching jobs, which means that he never really gets very efficient at any of them. Now, he's talking about actually pin manufacturing, but it's true of farmers also, right? You're buying seed at one point, you're planting, you're irrigating, you're fertilizing, you're plowing, you're carrying the food to market, you're selling. Smith suggested that if each stage of a process could be handled by separate people specializing in their own particular task, they could be more efficient. They could make more products. He called it division of labor, and the key to it is mass manufacture rather than small-scale cottage crafts. Smith also wondered what would happen if all the ways governments control the economy, by import duties and monopolies and fixing prices and wages, all those things mercantilist theorists said ought to be done, what would happen if all those were taken away? What if the economy was left entirely to its own devices if there was, as we call it today, free trade, a total free interplay of supply and demand, totally unregulated supply of labor without things like protections for jobs or workers or minimum wages or protection of companies if they fail? This would be called total laissez-faire economy. Let it happen. And he predicted that everyone would get wealthier, that the wealth of a nation as a whole would be greater because businesses would be freely competing and only the best would survive. Now, why Smith's predictions could even be conceivable has to do with changes in the organization of agriculture first. The techniques were actually not entirely new, but the British applied them on a massive scale, so great that it actually changes the shape of their society entirely. Now, the first thing has to do with who owns the land and how it's farmed. In early modern England, most land was still farmed communally. So people lived in villages, they cooperated with all the major tasks, they had a common plot of land on which to let their animals graze. And increasingly, tenants like this were pushed off their land because production methods were seen as inefficient and backward. And of course they were. Being a traditional society, they tended to do things as they had always been done for centuries. They planted the same crops, they plowed and harvested the same ways. And this kind of farmer is not likely to innovate because that might mean starvation. So starting around the 16th century and increasingly in the 17th and especially the 18th, this kind of subsistence farming gave way to capital-intensive farming. And often tenants were literally just kicked off the land. It was officially called enclosures. And the owner could now hire laborers to do exactly as he wished. And because these farms were run as a business rather than as a way to feed a family, there was this constant incentive to innovate, to try new methods, to produce more for less labor. So land ownership and the reason for farming has a lot to do with why innovation becomes feasible here. This new capitalist farmer did a couple of very important things. New three-field crop rotation systems were introduced, and that meant that you'd never have to leave any part of your land fallow. New crops were put in one cycle, and that would be clover or alfalfa, and those could be eaten by cattle, which, of course, if you have a large herd, which these people can afford, it's ideal. Now, remember, in the past, cattle would have been slaughtered in the fall just because it was so expensive to feed them over the winter when there's no grass or there's no oats or whatever. So in other words, you'd have to grow all this fodder just to store it to keep them alive. Well, the introduction, I know this sounds odd, but of turnips by Charles Turnip Townsend as a fodder crop changes all of that. They can be grown in the winter, the herd can be kept alive, and then you can keep a huge field of nitrogen-fixing legumes on a third of your land and grow crops on the other two. So the result really is just increased production. There is also a massive effort made at selective breeding, and it happens to plants. They start improving varieties to yield more grains per plant. Remember that seed yield ratio? Partly possible with more manure from the bigger herds, as well as improved cattle breeding. And the breeds, specialized breeds for meat, the cows become enormous. They have these special dairy cows that start giving several gallons a day, specialized poultry farms that breed super egg-laying chickens. Did you know that in nature, a chicken's natural cycle in the wild is about the same as a human's, meaning they would lay an egg every month. Today, they lay one every single day. And selective breeding does all of this. Now, remember, they don't understand genetics yet per se, but choosing the animals and plants with certain characteristics and just breeding those after several generations, it turns animals into food factories. There are also the first agricultural machines. The most famous of these is Jethro Tull's seed drill, which plants neat little even rows rather than just broadcasting seeds. But there are many others, and into the 19th century, there are threshing machines, combine harvesters like that of Hiram Moore in the 1830s that just reaps and threshes and winnows all in one sweep, and all sorts of other wonderful agricultural machines. These innovations result in much, much more food at much cheaper prices. And your average small farmer has begun to disappear in favor of these big capital-intensive farms. And the result is that Britain is actually the first place in the world to completely eradicate subsistence crises, famines, and even really minor setbacks in food. After the mid-18th century in Britain, they never really happen again. And what's the result? More food, remember Malthus, and you have more people. There is a stupendous population explosion that doesn't begin to halt until the late 20th century. Between 1800 and 1901, the population of Europe goes from 180 to 390 million people. And many of these people are by necessity forced to move into cities and look for other kinds of work. One example, the city of Manchester in northern England in 1800 has 75,000 inhabitants. In 1850, it has 400,000. That's a huge city, even by today's standards. London's population quadruples in the course of the century. Now that's part two in this grand puzzle. Britain, of course, had an excess of labor now. And what do you suppose that does to the cost of labor? It goes way down. There are lots of people looking for jobs, and they have to settle for the worst possible wages. And ironically, with the kind of jobs they can get, they often have no hope eventually of owning their own homes or businesses, and they have become what is generally called a proletariat. In other words, they are a working class, very different from peasants. And ironically, without any active incentives to delay marriage and maybe wait before starting up a household, these industrial workers tend to get married earlier. And they have larger families because, of course, they send the children out to do work also. And what that means is the population rises even more. So it's not just a matter of food supply rising and then more people, it's these other social and economic factors too. And this teeming mass of cheap labor means that manufacturing, which has formerly been done on a really small scale, producing mostly luxury goods, which remember, according to mercantilist theory, should be sold abroad in order to draw money into the country. And remember, the government in the past encouraged exports and discouraged local consumption of these goods by basically taxing them heavily. Well, again, think of Smith. What if these controls were all taken away? Which, of course, they are. Now manufacturers, following Smith's advice, begin to produce cheaper goods on a much larger scale using this division of labor. And they decide we can market these to anyone, whoever can afford them, abroad or even domestic consumers. We just want to sell more products. So we have entered an age not only of mass production, but of a consumer-oriented society. For the first time, the vast majority of things the average individual uses are no longer grown or made within the household or even bought from neighbors. They're bought at a store. And they are manufactured on a huge scale. And of course, everyone begins to have the same exact items, right? Mass production means standardization. It means predictability and usually lowering of quality to provide a cheaper product that can be sold on a greater scale. Now, think of the implications this has for processed foods. Classic and most important shift in manufacturing. Of course, it happens in the textile industry, but let's imagine a comparable scenario in the food industry. And notice that those two words have never really gone together before, right? Let's imagine someone who wanted to use ketchup, okay? In the 18th century, you could have consulted any number of great cookbooks. Hannah Glass has recipes for it. And remember, ketchup is one of those Southeast Asian sauces originally based on fish, but when the British brought it home, they made concoctions using mushrooms and other flavorings, or even Worcestershire sauce. That's a good example of these. It's soy, vinegar, molasses, tamarind, anchovies, and it's one of those sauces that is the first to be bottled and mass-produced in the 1830s. Tomato ketchup, probably invented in the U.S., and you would have had to cook down originally a whole batch of tomatoes with vinegar and sugar and cloves, give it that spiciness, onions. But by the time you reach the late 19th century, there aren't ketchup recipes in cookbooks anymore. Why? Well, a few companies, eventually Heinz, of course, dominates, starts mass manufacturing. They start in 1876, and within a generation, they control all ketchup manufacturing. And soon enough, everyone seems to be using the exact same product made in a factory, produced on an enormous scale, sold in every shop, because of course there's a revolution in transport too. And it's cheap because the company can buy up those ingredients like tomatoes in huge quantities. And everyone knows about it because they start advertising. They put ads in newspapers and magazines, and because they have all this surplus capital, they can continue to expand. They buy up smaller companies until basically they just control the supply of ketchup. And what happens to that artisan or homemade variety? It disappears. How many people make ketchup nowadays, right? So obviously, all of this doesn't happen overnight. In fact, it's still happening now. But the general trend from the early 19th century to the present is mass production, standardization, and craftsmen and farmers and artisans being turned into wage-paid workers. I mentioned a few other things that are absolutely essential to understanding this story. One of them is new sources of energy. The most important of these is James Watt's steam engine, and it's a really simple principle. You put a fire under a container of water. First it was iron, but they figure out stronger ways to make it, and it boils, and the steam expands and creates pressure, and that pushes a piston up through a cylinder. And the piston is connected to a shaft that transmits that energy to something like a loom, say, or if you put it sideways, picture a locomotive or a machine that pumps your ketchup into bottles, whatever it is. It's steam power. So this new technology is not only important in stepping up production and making factories themselves possible, because before, remember, you had to use water power and you had to put your operation near a stream, but now you can put a factory anywhere. You can put it right in a city, and that's where all the cheap labor is located. And obviously, railroads and canals and steamships, that means that goods can be moved faster and farther and cheaper to more and more customers. And that is an essential part of the whole story. 1830 is the first commercial railroad. But even earlier, they're using steam engines to transport coal. And that's, in fact, the new fuel of choice. It powers the machines. Iron is the new material of choice with which to make objects. Think of cast iron stoves and pans and farm implements and bridges. And of course, the machines themselves are made of iron now too. And there's now a huge mining industry as well as iron smelting factories. I can't even begin to exaggerate how great the changes in society were from the Industrial Revolution. First of all, workers no longer made their own food and household items for their own consumption. They didn't even buy them from local craftsmen anymore. Now you're wondering, why is that so important? There is no longer a connection to the producer, no input about the product. You know, in the industrial age, the manufacturer basically has to guess what that consumer wants or spend a fortune convincing them that they want it, even though it may not be in their own best self-interest to buy it. Let me give you a case in point. Money spent buying bread. Much of that now, Industrial Revolution era, goes to buying tea with sugar in it. And you wonder, well, why are people doing that? Well, to support what has become a huge sugar refining industry in London. And of course, all those colonial plantations to go with it. And it's in the consumers, is it in the consumer's best interest to eat sugar instead of bread? I mean, of course not. But what other negative effects? All that iron smelting and slag heaps are waste products, all the pollution from burning coal. And actually, many environmental historians contend that since the 18th century, we've really entered into a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene. Some people would put it at the last agricultural revolution, some people really here. And obviously humans are having an unavoidably large effect on the environment. And in some instances, it's larger than any other factor. But then there's the whole question of wealth, right? The Industrial Revolution produces enormous amounts of wealth. It goes for the privileged bourgeoisie, the wealthy middle class and investors and the people on up. But how about the workers? They never really feel like the product that's being made is theirs, that they have a stake in it or a pride in the fact that those things are being used or eaten by someone that they know. And again, when I say product, it certainly can be food too, right? I mean, think of a small cheese manufacturer, someone who sells directly out of her own home to people she knows in the village. And of course, she can't make a lot of this, and they're not standardized cheeses by any measure. And she can't afford the latest technology, but she knows when a customer returns the next week, she can get this direct pride in having made a good product, and the profit goes to her. That's the most important part. Now compare our artisanal cheesemaker to the industrial. You know, workers in the latter mix these enormous vats, and as long as they do what the boss says, what do they get? They get their wages. Good product or bad, doesn't matter. It has nothing to do with them. And honestly, I don't think that worker really cares because they're getting paid whether it's a good product or not. And even if it is a good product, it gets shipped far away to someone who they never meet. And the surplus profits of the whole process, where do they go? To the capitalist factory owner, not to the workers. So what that maker, cheesemaker, is now selling is really not cheese. It's her labor, right? That's all she gets. And as you can imagine, that process can be really dehumanizing. It kind of takes the pride and creativity out of making things and that capacity to enjoy working and become satisfied with our accomplishments. That is something that is uniquely human. According to Karl Marx, who may have gotten a lot of things wrong regarding communism, but I think he understood some really fundamental faults with capitalism. He put it this way. He said, all animals work, perform labor until they're full, and then they stop. Humans are kind of different. We can actually work more just for the sheer pleasure or for the benefit that we give to others. And pure capitalism and this form of factory labor seems to destroy that essential part of what it means to be human, what he called the species being. Now let's look a little more closely at how people's eating habits actually changed. Let's start with bread. And as we know, bread was a fairly gritty affair. Remember, they're still grinding with stones, and it's, you know, not very fine flour unless you're very wealthy. And remember also, yeasts are unpredictable, often they're sour, the wood-burning ovens give you sometimes a little burnt crust, or sometimes the loaf is misshapen from tossing it into the oven. And of course, that kind of bread goes stale in a day or two. In other words, it's pretty much like the stuff you'd have to pay several dollars a loaf for nowadays in a boutique artisan bakery, right? And most importantly is that it's different from place to place, from one baker to another, even, you know, season to season, the batches change. But what changes in the industrial era? Well, first, there is a new flour milling technique that was developed that could basically just roll over and squash the grains under intense pressure, and the rollers are actually metal now. And the process actually heats the flour up a little, and we know now that nutrients are lost in that process. Well, it doesn't matter, it becomes cheaper because it's much, much more of it is made. And manufacturers even say their bread is now whiter and purer because they're using these special rollers. And sometimes they actually remove more of the bran, which, you know, may or may not be better for you, but they often, to get it to be whiter, they would add something like chalk or anything that makes the bread whiter. Because in fact, remember, without regulation, there are no food safety laws yet. And in most people's minds, whiter bread meant better. I mean, think of the past. It had always been harder. You'd have to really, really finely bolt flour to get it to be white, and now a machine kind of takes the chaff away and all the whole meal to give you a really white flour. And remember, it used to be a mark of class. Well, now more and more people can buy it. And the incentive to produce more bread quicker meant that manufacturers have an incentive to use the flour quickly rather than let it mature, and that actually gives it a better flavor and helps it in baking. But these guys are in a hurry, so they began to search out artificial ways to make bread lighter and fluffier using chemicals. A variety of them are used to start. Alum in the early 19th century. What eventually they settle on is bleaching the flour with bromates. That makes it really white. It destroys the vitamin E, and then they add conditioners to make it sort of squishy and bouncier. And of course, the shelf life lasts much longer if it's in a plastic package eventually. Now, I am jumping the gun here, and I'm describing what takes place over the entire century. But in the end, what you get are white breads in the 20th century that have to have vitamins and minerals added back in to it in an attempt to sort of make up what's been removed by the processing. And people did protest. There's an English journalist, William Cobbett, who complained about people who are spending their hard-earned savings on this mass-manufactured bread when it could be made more cheaply at home and use much more pure ingredients. And in his mind, there was also something very wholesome about women's domestic duties. I mean, he thought it would lead to the breakdown of society if women were out working in factories and then spending their wages on this poor quality bread. In 1821, in a book called Cottage Economy, he wrote this: "Give me for a beautiful sight a neat and smart woman heating her oven and setting in her bread. And if the bustle does make the sign of her labor glisten on her brow, where is the man that would not kiss that off rather than lick the plaster from the cheek of a duchess?" Obviously, there are several ways to interpret this. It's a reaffirmation of women's subjection in an era when they finally had opportunities to work outside the home. But it can also be seen as a kind of nostalgic reverie for what was apparently a disappearing way of life. There's also a book written by a fascinating and strange figure in 1820 by the name of Friedrich Ackham. It's called The Treatise on Adulteration of Food and Culinary Poisons. And it explains that some manufacturers used copper to make pickles green. They add lead to give bright colors to candy. They put alum in bread, which we've heard of. They add brick dust to cocoa powder. They refine beer with iron sulfate. And it created, the book created this incredible furor and legal battles. And all sorts of other strange things happened. He was found tearing sheets out of a book in the library. That's a heinous crime, I know. But he was actually forced to leave the country. And people, you know, the moral of the weird story is that people selling products without any regulation often have enough money to win court cases against those who complain about them, at least initially. But the result, oddly enough, in Britain, the British didn't have any regulation at all until the 1860 Food and Drug Act. Nonetheless, the industrialization of bread making continued apace, along with these new chemical leavening agents. And the very first U.S. patent, in fact, went to this guy, Samuel Hopkins, in 1790 for potash. And it has a couple of different uses. It's a fertilizer, but it's also the earliest chemical leavener in quick breads, things like biscuits and pancakes even. It's sort of an ancestor of baking powder. In 1835, the English also started selling chemicals for use in baking, usually just an alkali mixed with an acid, so when it gets heated and wet, it releases carbon dioxide. And the result is that home baking tended to concentrate a lot more on quick muffins and scones and pancakes, and that's not in itself such a bad thing, but the chemicals might be. And it's bad, obviously, if you end up living just on those things. And it's interesting, in fact, that Europeans who make those kind of things without chemical leaveners, when they taste our baking soda, it's got this weird acrid flavor, and I tend to agree with them. Anyway, the diet of the average British family dramatically declined in terms of overall calories, percentage of protein, and most dramatically, the reduction of vitamins due to lack of fresh vegetables. If you live on bread, potatoes, scraps of bacon, and sweetened tea, you do not get a good diet. When Friedrich Engels described the diet of northern English industrial towns, and he knew these firsthand from his research, he said food among workers was reduced to a small piece of bacon cut up with potatoes. Lower still, even this disappears. And then only bread, cheese, porridge, and potatoes. And on the lowest rung of the ladder, among the Irish, potatoes formed the sole food. Now, the result of this was severe outbreaks of scurvy, vitamin C deficiency that causes your teeth to bleed and fall out. It eventually kills you. Widespread rickets, which is a vitamin D deficiency, which causes bone malformations in children. And of course, causes you to be rickety like a chair. That's caused by lack of sunlight as well as a poor diet. Remember, children are working in factories 6 days a week. And if you consider that a poor worker in 1830 might earn only enough to buy 7 4-pound loaves of bread for 5 shillings, that's just barely enough to keep a family of five alive. Potatoes are a lot cheaper. 1 shilling gets you 20 pounds. So if the family has to pay, you know, rent, clothes, all this other things, potatoes become increasingly a better option, you know, and anything left over you spend on tea and a little bit of sugar. Now, don't get me wrong, potatoes are good for you, you know, except with this increased demand, planting nothing but potatoes, especially in places like Ireland, something was bound to strike and end in disaster. And it did, beginning in 1845 and lasting until 1852, we are talking about a blight. And it hits other places in Europe too, Britain, Germany, all the way to Poland. What happens is the plants just rot into this brown sludge because of a fungus, Phytophthora infestans. And apparently, at this point, over a third of the Irish population depended primarily on potatoes for their food. And by one estimate, between 7 and 14 pounds of potatoes a day would be needed to stay alive. The demographer Arthur Young in the 19th century estimated that a family of six eats 252 pounds of potatoes a week. And all this when population is rising and the demand for potatoes increasing. An absolute disaster and deadly famine struck when the potato blight hit. About 1 million Irish died, about the same left for America and England, and the British government at first tried to help them with shipments of cornmeal, but a change of government the next year that brought in politicians who favored free trade thought, we're gonna hurt growers unless we allow the free interplay of supply and demand. And they thought the market would suffer if they tampered with the economy. So assuming Smith's invisible hand of nature would remedy everything, they stopped shipments of wheat and other grains. And so pretty much they let the Irish perish as a necessity, as a casualty of the market. And conversely, food exports from Ireland didn't stop, even in the middle of the famine. The only people who apparently wanted help at the time were the Quakers, and they formed relief societies, and obviously they cared more about human beings than the market, but there was only so much that they could do until eventually the government put in place a Soup Kitchen Act in 1847 that provided some food in cities, but still by the end, about a fifth of the population was gone. And this is a great example of how a single food can completely change the course of history. Ireland would be a very different place thereafter. And I think equally important, keep in mind, this famine was particularly modern in that it was largely man-made. Not only the result of monocropping, but made worse by the government policy and free trade. And to give you by contrast, Belgium, the infestation was nearly severe there, but they had other crops that they were growing and they imported other foods and they had decent policies. But in Ireland, it was absolutely devastating. And bad policy will be characteristic, we'll see, of many famines in the modern era. Now, as I suggested, not everyone was happy with this new situation of industrialized food production. And in the next lecture, we'll encounter what I like to call the counterculture food movements, the romantics, the vegetarians, even utopians.